Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC, on the transformation of companies and their culture, from decision makers for decision makers, or from entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs.
Welcome to the WHU podcast, Leading Corporate Transformation, powered by PwC. This is our 8th edition, and I'm very happy to be with you, dear listeners, again. As always in this podcast, with me is Gori von Hirschhausen from PricewaterhouseCoopers PwC.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Good that we speak today again. Special times, actually, we have to say, and of course, we will also refer to this. My name is Gori von Hirschhausen. I'm the leading partner of our management consulting practice within PwC, and my daily job is to support companies in their business transformation. And transformation is a key for us today and brings us to the company with a very essential business model, I have to say, that we are currently been visiting, and to our special guest, Eva Kienle. Eva, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Gori. Welcome here in Einbeck.
Eva, the first thing I would like to ask you is to give us a little introduction to yourself and to KWS Saat.
Happy to do so. My name is, as already mentioned, Eva Kienle. I'm a member of a 5-person executive board here of KWS. The company is headquartered in Einbeck, and we're one of the large global seed processing, breeding, and selling companies with a focus on some main, what we call field crops, which is corn, sugar beet, and cereals mainly, but also in vegetables since some years. We have over 70 locations worldwide that we either breed or trial or produce seeds and sell it all over the world. So a very global footprint and a very sustainable business model, as you said, in the true sense of the word, because we see seed breeding as the core of a sustainable farming and agriculture in these days.
So if I get it right, you are number four in the global competition, right?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it depends. Basically, you look at the global context or at a more European context. Globally, clearly, the industry is dominated by Bayer and by Corteva, which have the largest proportion in the Americas, which mm-hmm. is entirely a genetically modified market, so with GMO seeds. And both Corteva as well as Bayer have strong footprints in trade development, which is an essential part of their turnover in those markets. So that's why they are there since decades, and they have gained that market position on a global scale. If you move that and look into Europe, where it's clearly all non-GM markets, this changes significantly also the size, so the gap between the two leading and the others, because there it's on eye level just working on conventionally bred seed.
Wow, that's impressive.
If our seeds may seem to be, to the non-expert, like a rather simple product, right? I have a garden at home and, in the spring I go and buy, these little packages with a handful of little seeds in them. And it's quite amazing to have such a business around this of that size. Over the decades, it was possible to improve the quality of seeds tremendously, right? And based on that, the crop yields have increased, dramatically, allowing to feed more or less every year the world population. So with a look into the future, we talked a little bit about this, that the world population is going to still further increase. What do your scientists at KWS, KWS say? Is there still way to improve here? Is there still room for improvement? Can this development go on?
Mm. It has to go on, to be open and frank on that in that regard. And you mentioned it already. The agricultural sector is facing an enormous challenge globally. Is food security for a growing world population reaching 10 billion people roughly by 2050. That's the UN estimate. So at the same time, increasing climate challenges, protection of biodiversity, and also the fewer natural resources like water and other nutrients. So you can only become and sort of ensure this food security through plant breeding and innovation in plant breeding. We have, since over 160 years, been very successful in doing so. And there is also some studies out there that clearly indicate on from HFFA, so that on average and across all major arable crops worldwide cultivated, in the EU, plant breeding contributes to about 67% of innovation-induced yield growth. So it's all about increasing yield and getting more to feed and to eat out of the same acreage or of a reducing acreage. And without plant breeding, almost 50 billion cubic meter of water would be additionally needed today on a global scale. So 50 billion cubic meter of water. So you breed for getting more out with less input. And this is basically the equation of plant breeding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I will follow up with, bringing in also other perspectives here, because critics, I'm sure you're regularly confronted with these positions, argue against genetically modified plants. You already indicated that there's a kind of segmentation in your market between Europe and the Americas, for instance. And also critics point out that with huge parts of the of the land cultivated, but with only a handful of plant types only, that diversity is in danger. So what would you answer these people who take this rather critical look at the industry?
I think that to generalize here, the overall industry globally is not right. I think we have to go and look region by region or country by country and what's driving the population, the consumers, and the countries or regions globally. And there's a huge distinction between developing countries, already somehow developed countries, and the really rich and industrialized countries like we are in Europe or the North Americans are. So looking at to change in consumer habits about being more sort of reflecting on what you eat and maybe reduce meat consumption and on a, go for a healthier nutrition, etc. That's a first world, let's say, issue on really having the choice and having the freedom to take this decision. Whereas in other countries like in Africa, in Southeast Asia, India, South America, the people just want to reach that level where they can eat what they want. And the basic desire there is still, I want to be able to have regular meat. I want to be able to drink milk. I want to be able to have sugar and sweets and cakes. And this is why there is such a big distinction and why it's about the production output. So offer and demand. And what you're referring to, for example, is in South America, that's what is always communicated, strong monoculture or very, mm-hmm. very little crop rotation. And again, it's about the demand for soybeans being there that pushes the Brazilian farmers, purely economic entrepreneurs, to say, yeah, if there is enough demand, I'm going to offer this for the global market. It's very critically seen also globally, and I think it's part of the sustainability initiative from the United Nations, and that's also addressed by the Brazilian government to make this a little sort of less obvious. But again, I think the GMO discussion is a little outdated. It turns now more towards new breeding technologies. So the next new kid on the block is genetic genome editing. Became very famous with the Nobel Prize some years back, I think 3 years back, on the CRISPR-Cas gene scissors. Mm-hmm. And this is something that is working, and we are doing it also in plant breeding and improving plants through genome editing. So the next to be discussion is about when does actively changing a DNA of a plant is seen as being modified, and when is it also a sort of accelerated natural mutation that you're forcing up onto the plant? Mm.
So if the innovation that you are referring to that is about to come or that's already in progress, and the innovation that took place for the CFO, it also translates, of course, into investments, right? So if I remember it correctly, you spent approximately around about 250 million on R&D. So my question is, you expect for this new developments that it will be even increasing because it's around about 20% of your revenue, right? So do you expect it to even go further up? Is that enough? Will you be able to manage it on this level? Will it go down?
Yeah. No, that's an interesting question. We are also getting often from the capital market is, and we are spending all R&D initiatives in expenses. So it's all going through the P&L. We are not capitalizing on any of that one. So it's and you're right, it has been a little bit above 250 last year. And there's a strategic pillar and a strategic aim to always look between 18% or 20% of sales. So by the way, our sales increase, we will put more and more means into the R&D mm-hmm. budget mm-hmm. also. So yes, it will increase in the way our sales increase. The importance being is that developing a new variety of whatever crop it takes, up to 7, 8, 9 years sometimes. So the return on invest is very difficult to calculate because the money you spend today, you can only see in 8 or 9 years. And breeding and selection is about you choose 10 plants, you throw 8 away and you go on with 2. And you multiply those 2 and you enlarge the pool of those 2. Again, you cross, you select, you throw 8 away. So there is per se in doing breeding, there is a natural waste that without you can't do. And of course, roughly 60-70% of the budget is applied breeding. So breeding stations, plants, going out, being in the field, selecting. This is something the larger you go and the more product you offer, you have to just increase your plots, your trial areas, etc. 20% is then breeding, called breeding services, like more and more bioinformatics, but also marker labs, etc. And roughly 10% is what you would really say is fun money, but so really going into innovation, looking into new ways of doing the things. But you in getting more global and also to address, as I mentioned, those climate change, increasing different climate change topics, you have to enlarge on your test basis that where you do the breeding and the selection.
Oh, that's very interesting to hear how innovative these product of seeds is, because as Martin said in the beginning, we all would expect it's a simple product, but it's a very, very innovative product. So final question, do you believe that this innovation rate, this high innovation rate and this incredible and impressive innovations of the past, you think this speed of innovation can be kept?
It will even accelerate because again, there is those new technology out being from a informatics, so data analytical perspective that help a lot, but also, as I mentioned, through those new, for example, genome editing techniques, it's all aiming at speeding up the development process of a new variety and of a new sort of plant that is more resistant to diseases, to insects and whatsoever. So it's all aiming at shortening the development process and bringing products faster to market.
Yeah, maybe just one further question that intrigues me. We are now located, we are at your headquarters at Einbeck, a small town in Lower Saxony. So to me, that's, you know, brings at least two interesting questions. You know, being so much in the German, you know, rural countryside, how can you from here serve the world? That's maybe one question. And also, where do you do your R&D? Because you specialize in crops that normally are not grown here, like soybeans. I suppose you would have to have a decentralized approach to that because of climate and soil, you know, conditions.
Yeah. So we have two main R&D locations, and if I mean R&D locations, I'm talking about labs and about greenhouses and about really research. One, the main here is in Einbeck. So we have roughly 800 people working here in breeding and in research in the labs, in the greenhouses, and there is another second research center that we have in St. Louis in the US, our Gateway Research Center, that is a small lab really working on innovation and on genome editing and improving technologies for being added to plant breeding. But you're right, so once it leaves the lab and it becomes to a testing, trial and selection process, we go out into the countries. You have to localize the plants, so you can only produce, test and try whether they are suitable for that climate zone or the market in that country. So by no means you can take a corn or sugar beet that has been sort of initially bred here in the greenhouse or here in a trial. You cannot take this to Italy or to the US to be marketed and grow there. So it's all with regards then to the stations of our breeders. It's all very, very decentralized, basically all over the place where we are also going into the markets.
Very interesting.
So maybe coming back to the origin or the history of the company, if I understand it right, KWS stands for Kleinwandslebender Saatgut, right? So, and it's not Einbeck Saatgut. Can you explain this? What is Kleinwandsleben?
Yeah, Kleinwandsleben is the DNA. So that's the nucleus of the company. And Kleinwandsleben is a small town close to Magdeburg, so a little bit southwest of Berlin. That's where initially the founder families or the families had a sugar factory. Mm-hmm. In Kleinwandsleben, mm-hmm. and that's why it was called Kleinwandslebener Saatzucht GmbH at that point in time. And so they were starting looking on how can I improve my input into my sugar factory to increase the output. So how can I get more sugar out of this beet? And they started to work on sugar beets, on trying to improve the sugar content. And 1856, that's the foundation year of the company. So that's exactly when Gregor Mendel did his very first outcome on how could that work. So actually the family started at the same time experimenting in something they just didn't know, but try and error. And they found out that by selection of varieties with a higher yield, you can constantly improve. And that's why the core crop that the company is based on is sugar beet. And since then we grew. And then after the Second World War, with the Yalta conference, after the Yalta conference and the new repartition of Germany, the English at that time the English an army was in Kleinwandsleben, based in Kleinwandsleben, and they realized that this part would become Russian, mm-hmm. and they had also they had learned how intensively you can use the sugar beet for producing sugars, and they just wanted to ensure that this knowledge doesn't fall to the Russians at that time, and wanted to safeguard it for themselves. So they put machines, breeders, and especially the germplasm, so the elite lines, they put all on some lorries, 6-7 lorries, and they went west. And this was the farmost western land plot that belonged to the family, and that's why we ended up in Einbeck.
Very interesting. Huh?
Very interesting.
I didn't know.
Yeah. I would like to ask one more question about, because it's so interesting, about research and combined about the company history. Looking at the timeline, I saw that you have developed a lot of your business in joint ventures with international partners. Is that necessary because the conditions that you find in different parts of the world are so different that you need to engage with, I don't know, Brazilian partners or Asian partners? And and how do you manage the joint ventures to get success out of these joint efforts? Mm.
That's also a one of the sort of like the basic values of KWS, that if we start being interested in someone or potentially being a good partner to go on further or to work together, we aim for partnerships first. So we are not going for a typical, you would say, M&A strategy. You evaluate a target, you offer a big check, and just integrate the new business and you make it become part of yours. So all the successful, later on now 100% owned subsidiaries, we have started off with partnerships, be it 50-50, be it 81, if you look at Lojo, so the Lojo Petkus rye cereals company, like in Brazil, where we initially had a 51 stake, the old owner, founder, still a 49% stake. And it's a little bit like in Germany, you would say, Ehe auf Probe. So you first move together in the same apartment, you look out how it works, and then you ask for marriage rather than saying, well, let's go and get married. And after maybe a year or two, you find out saying maybe not the ideal deal fit.
So what's the success rate? How many joint ventures, enter into a marriage, and how many are dissolved before?
Yeah, the ones that are not made on purpose for remaining as they are, and I'm coming to that in a minute, is all ended up on our ends. So we haven't ever dissolved a partnership that we went into initially. We have China, which is very, very special. So China, you are not allowed to have more than 49% in a food supply company as a foreign company. So there is no way mm-hmm. we would ever own 100% of a Chinese company. And our U.S. corn partnership with our French colleagues from Limagra is a 50-50 on purpose, because there clearly we have both had our learnings that as a standalone company, you are not big enough and you are not sort of powerful enough also by the knowledge and the resources to gain ground in the U.S. market. And that's sort of a really Zweckgemeinschaft to move the American market forward. So that's why we will remain there also in a 50-50 joint venture.
Looking again at your competitor landscape, it looks like there are some real big players, right? So when it comes to merger and acquisition, this also very innovation and R&D heavy business that you're in. How good are you doing here?
I would say we are doing really good, because you see it as the number of new varieties and new registrations that we get year after year, which is an increasing number. So the real sort of the to judge on the output of the R&D organization, you can look at the new varieties that are registered globally on a global scale. So we are getting better there year after year. And that would be a first sign also if you fade out in your innovation funnel and your product pipeline. If you see that the product development is slowing down, that's a really first sign to pay attention for. So we are not doing really bad there. So, and that's what's important for us. We could always look at the others and saying it's a multiple of money that they invest into. So they are investing a lot into trade development, as I mentioned initially, and they are then returning or getting the return on licensing out those trades. So that's also a good chance for us, getting more and more familiar than compared to priors that we can license in those trades. So we do not necessarily have to develop them on our own. So there is more and more cooperation and licensing models also in the industry than some 10 years back.
Oh, interesting. If I read this right, there was one acquisition which took place in 2019. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about Pop Friend Seeds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was our one of our steps into the vegetable market. So mm-hmm. we have sort of looked into our strategic plan for the next 10-15 years, and again, the nutrition habits and eating habits, especially in Europe but also globally, clearly indicate that vegetables is a extremely fast growing market. It's extremely heterogeneous mm-hmm. by crops, also within a crop, by country, by species. So I don't know how many different tomato or pepper varieties there are out globally. And we have said we want to be in that vegetables market. Mm-hmm. So we have aligned our strategy on a twofold way. One is we go through what we call greenfield approach. So we literally go out, we buy land plots, we build greenhouses, we recruit beaters, we license in germplasm from others, and we start breeding on our own. So this mm-hmm. is the more the 10-15 year path before you get ever a variety out that you can sell. So this is just cost. And the other thing that we say, we sort of empower this with add-on acquisitions. And Popfriend was one of those occasions that we could hop on, so to say, and have a quick start, jump start into the spinach market, because they are the world market leader in spinach seeds.
So that it really sounds so interesting to learn how long it takes till you develop these innovations and till they really hit the market and make the revenues and get the profits back. So I think it's a good time, I would say, to look at your ownership structure. And I think Martin has some questions on this.
That's right. The ownership structure is interesting because you're a kind of a hybrid. You're on the one hand stock listed, and on the other hand, families play a very important role in the ownership. Among them, a family that has been, you know, in the company and with the company, in fact, has founded the company more than, as you said, 160 years ago. Can you say a little bit about this, how this plays to each other, you know, a stock-listed family firm?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, but it's, for me, it's personally as a CFO, it's a very win-win situation, so to say. The business model requires a really long breath and an understanding exactly that the investment of today is hopefully at best returning in 8, 9, 10 years. So it's a bet into the future, which is very difficult to explain to very return-oriented investors that look for short-term dividend, share price increase, etc., and have to also deliver certain returns to their shareholders or if they're funds or whatever. So making an understanding that it's really the long-term view that we aim at is something that a normal investor, so to say, would have a hard time to understand. So why would he invest if he's not returning within 2 to 3 years and he needs the money to invest into something else? That's where the family helps, because we are not driven by the capital market requirements and capital market needs. We haven't to deal at all with activist investors. We can focus with a clear strategic vision, keep our course on what we have said is the right step, next step to take, rather than being pushed right and left and maybe do a return by someone who has a good idea or something that's showing up on the horizon that we should test case, etc. So that's where the family and really the founding families, of course, have a deep understanding on how it works. So the main profession of the family's members, the former CEOs, is they are breeders. So they have studies in agriculture and in agrobusiness and breeding. So you have to understand that it takes a little longer than just writing a new song or creating new Apple iPhone.
Mm-hmm. But it's so interesting, right, to hear, Eva, what you were saying, because we had Julian Deutz the other day, and he was referring that they did this delisting of Springer. And one of the reasons was because they were so innovative in their digitization of the business model that he was saying very funny, he said, maybe we were not good in telling the story, or the capital market didn't get our story because we were so much ahead. We were talking about the digital future of publishing that we decided it's better to have the opportunity to keep focus. And it sounds like in your case, it's the same. You need so much innovation, and it takes quite some time from the innovation till you hit the market and till you get the profits, that might be this kind of private ownership very helpful to keep on track. So
I think it depends on your investment target. So if you invest to achieve high returns, then certainly potentially business models like Springer or ours is not the ideal one. If you look for a risk sharing or a broader portfolio and a low risk investment in your portfolio, then you're absolutely rightly placed there. And we have interesting times ahead, because with the whole ESG sustainability discussion, KWS will be definitely at the forefront to be able to serve those expectations of the longer, the more investors saying, okay, how good and what are you doing to fulfill the sustainability targets?
Interesting.
Mm. So coming back to the family structure, the Büchting family that plays a central role in the company, I come back to that also in just a moment. The Büchting family, if I understand it correctly, traces its origin back to the original founders. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the Oetker family, very well-known
family
in the business cycles of business circles of Germany, is also invested in KWS. Can you say how that has come about?
So the sort of the founders were very close sort of families, which is the Rabetke and the Giesecke family. So the Klein-Wandsleben Ersatzhof was also formerly Rabetke and Giesecke. And the Büchting family is one of those generations of one of those founders. And the other branch decided to sell their entire share into KWS, I think it was around the mid-80s. And when they were looking out for potential interested investors to take over their whole share package, so to say, they wanted to have a closed deal. Of course, the other part of the family was getting very nervous, because they said, we do not want to have sort of whomever into the company for such a big stake. That was roughly 25% then. And so they searched actively for someone with the same mindset, with an entrepreneurial perspective, with someone that is a little closer to our business maybe than to any other business, or not a car manufacturer, etc. And that's how they ran, coincidentally, through a common friend into Arend Oetker. Mm-hmm. And he found it so interesting at that time that he said, okay, that's a super cool investment. I'm going to take those 25%. And that's how he how he became one of the major shareholders together with the Büchting family.
All right. So the Büchting family has been central in effectively running the company for many decades. Karl Ernst Büchting was CEO, I've read that, for 23 years, and then Andreas Büchting again for a very long period from 78 to 2007. In the meantime, you have another non-family CEO, but I've read, that's public knowledge, that at the end of the year, again, a member of the Büchting family will take over the helm of the company as the CEO, Felix Büchting. And Hagen Dünbostel, who is the CEO now, will eventually, after cooling off, switch to the chair position of the Aufsichtsrat of the supervisory board. So is that a good thing, this continuity within one family? And how do your non-family shareholders see this?
Mm. That's a very, very, very interesting question. I think it was not on purpose, but naturally necessary that 2007, there was the first time ever that there was not a family member ready mm-hmm. to step into the executive board role when Andreas Büchting retired. And that is the first time that they took an external expert to run the board, which was Philipp von den Busche at that time. And it worked out well. So I think and that's an experience that also was more having this extraordinary situation of not being able to have someone of the family on the board. And it's, I think it's less about the family, but it's about the knowledge on breeding and the knowledge on agriculture and agro-business. And all Büchting members who served on the board are deeply rooted and entrepreneurs in farming and in also understanding what it's about. So if that's sort of like product development, if you're not an expert in product development, it's getting very tough. Mm-hmm. And this is, this is what the capital market recognizes and saying, looking from outside in or bringing people from outside in, at that you would need that one expert on the board that is able to judge on where do we have to bring the company with regards to product development, to countries, to crops, so which is the way to drive the offer forward. And if you're not an expert in breeding or in plant development, you cannot do it. You can simply not do it. So that's something that I think is the advantage of being a family member that is from the roots. An expert in that area.
I mean, with this business model and the work that you do here at KWS, of course, looking at the current situation with the Putin regime war on Ukraine, a question that comes to our mind before we switch to the more, let's say, internal view from the CFO office to KWS. Let's finish up the view on the company with the question, how does this Ukraine war impacts your business? Because everybody knows that it's called the bread basket of Europe, right? Mm. So that must have a big impact.
It does have. Unfortunately, we had to issue a profit warning last Friday. So we went out publicly because we did our math now that the conflict unfolded into where it stands today. Mm-hmm. March is the beginning of the sowing season, so we had to take assumptions on how will the agriculture work these days in Belarus, in Ukraine, in Russia. Russia and Ukraine are two of our main markets, both in cereals, and unfortunately the cereal season is over because cereals is a winter crop. Mm-hmm. But now it's sowing time for sugar beets and for corn, and of course we have taken expectations about a significant reduction, if not complete cancellation, of this year agricultural season, at least in Ukraine. And that's why of course, we took that into account regarding our profit expectation for this year. But the most concerned, more than with our financial results, we are with our employees. We have operations in both countries. We have people in Ukraine spread all over the place, also our sales guys. And we're really very worried, and we have set up a crisis committee immediately, and we have done everything we could do from here to really help them and make them sort of assemble and having a shelter in our production facility in the southwestern area, which is not yet so much under conflict. Mm-hmm. And of course, we are helping anyone out who can still go out and wants to go out. And we are bringing basically family members, wives, kids, parents, we're bringing over to other KWS locations and help them staying
here.
Good to hear.
So if I'm sure a lot of our listeners will also have worries and fears about possible wider consequences of this conflict. Also, not just immediate traumatic situation in Ukraine, but also for the supply of food for world population. As Gori said, Ukraine and also Russia are important countries for food production, for crop production. What do your experts say? What do you as an expert know about what are possible consequences for the markets in wheat and corn and other mainstays of human products?
Yeah, it's a very serious topic here. The Black Earth region is the Kornkammer Europa, so that's basically where the largest cereals production, not only for Europe but also for Africa, is happening. Almost 40% of the needs for Europe and Africa in wheat is grown there in Ukraine mainly. So it's all apparently, or hope, we don't know. So assuming it's not being able to produce this year. You can see it already in the commodity prices. So the wheat price has been around 170, 180 last year. It's now over 400. So there's an explosion, of course, of commodity prices, which is not only relevant for those people who need the commodity, but also, of course, for input prices, and also, of course, for the arable land in other areas in our region, because now people are looking for where else can we grow? And of course, everyone is addressing now farmers in Europe, Western Europe, Southern Europe, on do you have plots available where we can try to compensate for this fallout in cereals planting and harvest? And this is serious. Same will come for corn now. Also a large part in sunflowers. So that will have an impact, and definitely on food supply in Africa. And last time we had a shortage in food supply, everyone will remember, was the Arab Spring. So there's a lot of scenarios that don't allow for big joy.
Mm-hmm. So that really sounds like, I think we all think it's a very sad time to see.
Absolutely.
To see this wrong and unethical things happening, and to see not just the innocent people die and suffer, but also as you're pointing out, what will be the impact on the whole world? And when it comes to food supply, you really know that we talk about the fundamentals, right? So, wow, this is really I have to say, and I have to admit, it's very hard to handle and to take. And we always need to be careful to not sound cynical when we talk business in these times. But for myself, I'm a strong believer that that's the best way how we can deal with that at this moment, while all our thoughts, I think, are with the Ukraine
people.
So, but having this said, maybe we can switch to your role as a CFO of KWS. So maybe the broad question to start it off, what is the biggest challenge for you being the CFO in such an innovative but also long-lasting investment cycle business? How do you manage performance?
I would say for me as a CFO, but also as a person, I would say one of the big challenges is a rather, as you said, it's a steady, maybe slowish, but quite rather complacent organization. So it's not full of energy, driving, fast changing. Like, for example, the PE environment is very pushy, looking for quarterly results. So there's a lot of drive and energy. So alerting an entire organization, prepare for change and make it fun and interesting to sort of look every day at new things and embrace change, that is somehow difficult or it takes a lot of effort, especially if you always have had extremely good times or rather been ever in a situation of have to tighten the belt or whatever. So That's something where KWS is like sort of a little sort of paradise. And if you come in and shout about, well, let's become more digital, let's move things forward, it's like, okay, why? So that's, I think, the main challenge on creating lust for really going out and doing things different and moving forward if you're feeling absolutely fine and comfortable in where you are right now.
So that's interesting, because maybe we can talk about a project, I think, that sets the frame for all of this. If I remember it correctly, there was this Project 1A that mm-hmm. you started, which had the idea to keep the corporate and R&D roof flat, as you said once to me, and to have the, let's say, core processes in the business units, but also having the support processes bundled and professionalized in business services. Can you talk a little bit about this project and mm-hmm. how this I think very, let's say, business driven idea fits into this very innovative driven mm-hmm. business model of KWS?
So we operated since 2010 with regional shared service centers. We called them shared service centers, but we were sort of bundling them regionally, but not really process and sort of system wise. And we realized that with the very different and heterogeneous growth patterns and needs in the different countries and regions, we would completely sort of not be able to manage the support in an adequate, cost-efficient way going forward, not even talking about systems adaptations on the ERP landscapes or whatsoever. So we've said this will be an end-to-end sort of change and movement every time, which is not possible. And we decided really to streamline, focus, and concentrate the support functions, because that is a standardizable process, and it's not too much distinct from paying an invoice in Russia to paying an invoice in Germany. And that's the journey we embarked on in 2016-17 with design phase. Then 2018 we kicked really the transformation off, and we have moved now in the last 3 years, starting Western Europe. Sort of we went east and we took country by country into the new global shared service center in Berlin, but also the other functions are centralized either in Einbeck or in Berlin, and we serve, let's say, the KWS world from here with anything than some business partner roles in the countries. And of course, this works only with a large, huge digital tool set that is basically the heart of the machine room of the transaction center. And that's also now where in reality you find out on how much you can still ignore a digitalized process locally if you continue just sending physically the invoice around your factory in somewhere in the world. And the people at the GTC just are waiting there and saying, why isn't the process getting any faster? So that's what I mean by saying, if you continue wearing your old shoes, although you have a very nice, beautiful pair of shoes standing next to you, it doesn't really help. So that's where we are today.
The challenges of the reality.
Mm-hmm. Eva, can you say a little bit more about the advanced digital technologies that you're using? What role does data analytics play? How much use do you make of, I would assume, the large data pool that you accumulate over time of your business? You said how long your cycles for business development are, for instance, and so on. So data, I would assume, plays a big role. How do you manage these processes? How do you employ possibly advanced analytics in these processes?
I would say the largest area where we use since quite some time already big data is in bioinformatics, so in quantitative analytics, in breeding, in selecting, in finding patterns, mm-hmm. in breeding results, in plant behavior, in weather patterns, et cetera, to really overlay all those data that you have accumulated over years. Now it's also added by images, so satellite images, drone images, et cetera. And that's where you get through those data points more and more insights into a specific point in time on a specific plot with a specific plant or specific varieties on what is going on there. So that's the main area was used. We have started digging into customer information. So by adding more and more digital front ends to communicate and interact with our customers, mostly farmers, but also dealers, and trying to understand what their needs are and what their behavior is with regards to specific markets and specific crops, and also needs with regards to agro service once it's planted. So what is the service needed during the year? And of course, then on the admin or support side, it's the analytics of transactions and saying, where have we sort of like process outliers? Where do we spend too much time for paying invoices? Where do we lose on discount possibilities because of late paying? Where do we lose applications or applicants because the process takes too long? So that's of course where you can the qualitative judging on KPIs use on from analytics.
Oh, I think we need another podcast for this because that sounds so interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot there.
There's a lot there to explore. But maybe coming to you as a person, Eva, it was very interesting to learn that you have a very diverse background. So my question is, how important was it for you that you have made all this experience working global corporates, working for private equity backed companies and going through different industries to be the CFO of such an interesting company like KWS? So yeah, what would you advise young people to do to become or to get the chance to become a CFO of such a company?
I think most importantly, you have to be true to yourself, to what you want, and you have to move and change. So don't wait and let the life do something with you, but take it into your own hands, what you like to do and would like you to, and step up if you see interesting projects, interesting jobs, interesting opportunities out there. I think that's the most important. And it has to make fun. Fun is maybe said too easily, but you have to get up in the morning and be full of energy to do what you do this day. So if you do your job for money, that's not the right thing to do. Yeah. And you will be rather less successful and suffer a lot from needing to do something that you actually would maybe not so much like to do. I think that's the most important piece. The learning I had is I love changes. So I love seeing new things, exploring new things, exploring new countries, new cultures, new coworkers. And sort of the red thread in that is a little bit the transformation part. And I always hopped on opportunities where there were transformation topics ahead or things to be changed. And that's what I like. So I'm not the everyday same job 9 to 5. That's not my piece. And that's basically why I came along or across a lot of different challenges in different industries.
Okay.
So Gori remarked on the breadth of your experiences. You worked in a public utility, you worked for Walmart Germany, but you also worked for two PE firms. And it strikes me that, you know, the business you're in now with a 160 plus year history, strong family involvement, is kind of a antipode maybe even to PE. So what is it that you've taken with you from the PE world, from the companies that worked for that were run by PE firms that you can apply now at KWS?
I have to say, as a CFO, especially if it comes to absolutely deep dive finance topics, financing, tax, et cetera, you're quite often very alone with whom to talk to and whom to challenge and discuss your ideas. So the nice thing with PE investors is you always have dozens of people around you where you can really sort of brainstorm, get your ideas done, et cetera. It's all experts in finance. They all know how to do a good deal, how to develop a company, where the strategy has to be put in place. They're ruthless on the project plans, the milestones, and metering the achievements and what is needed to get there. So it's a very tough, let's say, exercise you're pushed through. And I think that's one learning I really took with me, in saying, how can you achieve things that for maybe a normal complacent person would seem very difficult, if not impossible. So not shying away from saying, if we do this and this and this, we can make it. So that's really a PE attitude I would clearly see, sort of really judging everything with open eyes. And it's not with, no one has done it so far, and maybe it's dangerous to go into that country. It's really all in, I would say. So that's an attitude and a way of working that is very, very helpful. On the other side, that's always two-sided medal. that's sort of maybe that short-sighted, very short-sighted and very pushy thinking that is at the forefront of driving a lot of decisions in private equity. And that is something where I more than once would have taken a wrong decision for the better of the company or the employees long term, but where I realized that that's far beyond the investor horizon. Mm-hmm. And sort of they didn't care and saying, well, that's then up to the next owner, etc. And I say, well, to me, it's a little sort of too egoistic and in that sense. And that's something where I was potentially deliberately looking for something that is not looking for the own investment horizon only, but also for the next mm-hmm. and the after one and the whatever. And that's exactly what KWS is bringing along, is you look into generations to come and saying, what I have here, I want to give into the next 5, 6, 7 generations. I just don't want it for me and cash in on my heritage, but I want to keep this up for the succeeding generations.
So if we can expect you to stay in the role for longer, from what we heard.
Until retirement, but it's not forever.
So, Eva, thank you. First of all, thank you so much for this great talk. It was really, really interesting. We have a final question that Martin always likes to raise, and I would like to hand over to Martin for our final question for today.
Yes, it has become a tradition in this podcast to ask our guest and whether you have a recommendation for our listeners for a book or maybe another podcast or some other medium, whether you have something to recommend.
Yeah. I think if you go the classical route, you want to impress someone, but I'm sure everyone has read, of course, you go for Little Prince of Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. I think just in during this tragic sort of happenings of the last weeks, I came across a book again I liked very much, because it took the hardcore part of North Korea very to the light side. And it's a book called Kim and Struppi from Christian Eisert. That's a young guy, actually born in the 70s, educated in the DDR. Of GDR, and he had a book in school where there was a huge colored toboggan in one of the leisure parks in North Korea. And he always wanted to go and see this large colored toboggan. And he managed to get a trip done to North Korea. And he's writing this book about his experience on this trip 3 or 4 weeks into North Korea. And of course, he had always two guards, observers from the government with him, and he called them Kim and Struppi. And that's very funny how he's writing, but also about the impressions of this country, about the population, about how he experienced this country. So that's maybe something that is getting a little bit of light side on one of the countries that we would judge being not into our worlds.
Very interesting. Eva, many thanks.
Thank
many
you very much, Martin.
Indeed, for having Rory and me here.
Yeah. It was fun.
I'm back.
Thanks.
And for this very, very interesting talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
We also thank you, dear listeners, for spending time with us.
Tuning in. Yes. For tuning in.
And we look forward to meeting you all again very, very soon.
Yeah, there's more to come, and it keeps as interesting as this time. So
thank you very much to everyone.
That was Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management. Powered by PwC. Editorial team, Marvin Schuna and Simon Gerlach.